We're in Nehemiah chapter 5. The book of Nehemiah in chapter 5. And if you don't mind, I'm excited about the book of Nehemiah. I love how the Lord orchestrates things sometimes. My Bible reading today in the Old Testament took me through the book of Nehemiah. It's only about 20 pages, and so I got to read the entire book this morning, and I thought that's a blessing. Looking for particular things as I read through it and getting all the way through at the same time. So we're in Nehemiah chapter 5. Quick reminder, Nehemiah chapter 1, Nehemiah's burden as he asked about the walls of Jerusalem. Nehemiah chapter 2, Nehemiah's faith as he asked the king for permission to go back to Jerusalem to survey the city and rebuild the walls. Jeremiah chapter 3, Nehemiah's faith, or Nehemiah's workers, all those that worked with him in chapter 3. Chapter 4 last week, we looked at Nehemiah and his opposition, and Sanballat and Tobiah and the enemies. Now we get to chapter 5. What a great chapter. 19 verses long. We're going to look tonight at Nehemiah's leadership. Nehemiah's leadership. It was Lee Robertson that is credited with the expression or the saying, and I'm not sure he originated, but he popularized it. Everything rises and falls on leadership. And that is a true statement, is it not? Look at our country right now. Leadership is what gets you through difficult times. Leadership is what gives confidence to people or otherwise. Leadership is a very important thing. The opposition that came against them in Nehemiah chapter 4 was overcome by good leadership. And that was the leadership of Nehemiah. In chapter 5, that opposition or that leadership is going to be challenged again, and we're going to see Nehemiah come through with flying colors, and it's going to be good for us to see exactly how that transpires. We're just going to read the first 6 verses as we start tonight. Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 1 to 6. And there was a great cry of the people and of the wives against their brethren, the Jews. For there were that said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore we take up corn for them, that we may eat and live. Some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses, that we might buy corn because of the dearth. There were also that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tribute, and that upon our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants, and some of our daughters are brought into bondage already. Neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. And Nehemiah says this in verse 6, and I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Let's go to the Lord together in prayer. Father, we ask you now to bless the reading of your word, and Father, now bless our study of your word. Give us something tonight that will encourage us, that will enlighten us. Father, that will show us the conditions that Nehemiah faced so many thousand years ago. And yet, Lord, show us that we have the same elements of problems in our society, in our world, in our country, and even in our churches today. And Lord, help us to have Nehemiah leadership. Bless our study of your word tonight, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. I want you to notice in chapter 5 and verse number 1 that Nehemiah tells us there was a great cry. The word great occurs 28 times in the book of Nehemiah. 28 times in a book that's only 13 chapters long. The word great. And in this great cry, it talks about, chapter 1, verse 3, it talks about a great affliction. Chapter 1, verse 5, it talks about a great God. Chapter 1, verse 10, it talks about great power, that our great God has great power. Chapter 3 and verse 27 talked about a great tower that the Tekoites built. Chapter 4, verse 1, there was Nehemiah had great indignation, all these greats. Chapter 4, verse 14, the Lord is great. Chapter 4, verse 19, the work is great. That's just the first seven, and this is the eighth of the greats in chapter 5, verse 1. Another 20 to come afterward. But he said there was a great cry of the people. In the midst of the great work by a great God, with people putting their hands to do this, there was a great cry. I want you to notice who it was that cried. In verse number 1, it was two groups, the people and of their wives. That's an unusual combination. There was a great cry of the people. Now we're talking about the Jewish people, those that are involved in the building of the walls of Jerusalem. They had a great cry, meaning they had a complaint. And not only did the people have it, but also of their wives. I can't think of another place in the Bible where the women speak out like this in complaint about something. The people murmur and complain all through the Bible. But this is the only time I can think of when it specifically mentions that the wives or the women, they complained also. That great cry. Why was it great? Well, because there was a burden. There was a heartache. There was a terrible situation that caused these faithful, hard workers to have a cry. And they cried out. The Bible tells us what their cry was. There's three complaints that they issue. Notice this, it says in verse 2, "For there were that said," I like this, the Bible's so crystal clear. It says in verse 2, "For there were that said," I've underlined that in my Bible, because in verse 3 it says, "Some also there were that said." And then verse number 4, "There were also that said." See how that's laid out so clearly so you and I can understand it? There were three different complaints issued in this cry. The people and the wives had three different issues. "There were that said," verse 2. "There were some also there were that said," verse 3. "And there were also that said," in verse 4. Three different groups of these people and wives had a complaint about something that was going on. Now let me say this, and carefully. Complaining spreads. When you get a complaining spirit, it will breed. And you will associate with other people of a like spirit. Complaining is a hard thing to deal with because the complaints don't have to be legitimate. The complaints don't even have to be real. All they have to do is be complaints. Don't be a complainer. We read about those that murmured in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It talks about those that murmured in the wilderness and how God dealt with them. That was a dangerous thing. God does not like murmuring and complaining. And yet here was a great cry, and I say that to contradict this. This was legitimate. This was sincere. This was real. You remember in Acts chapter 6 there was a problem as the church had exploded and grown. That there was a murmuring and there was a complaining among the people about the Grecians because their wives were neglected in the daily ministration. Sometimes there are things, complaints that are legitimate that need to be addressed. And this is definitely one of them, as we're going to see in this chapter. The first complaint in verse number 2 was, "We, our sons and our daughters are many. Therefore we take up corn for them that we may eat and live." Now there's three complaints listed, and see if I can communicate this correctly. I believe we're looking at three different classes of people within this. Those in verse number 2 said, "We, our sons, our daughters are many, therefore we take up corn for them that we may eat and live." This group of people did not own any land. They did not have farms. We think of the book of Ruth. You remember the problem with Ruth, the Moabitess? They had, as they went back to Bethlehem, they had no bread. There was nothing there. And so Ruth would go out in the field of Boaz. And when the reapers would go out and glean the corn, she would go to the corners of the field because the Mosaic law told the reapers that they were not to reap all the way into the sharp corners. They were to round the corners and leave that for the poor people to come and get for themselves. And Ruth the Moabitess, being one of those poor people, didn't own any land. She was allowed to go into that field and she was allowed to reap from those corners. I think that in verse number 2, we're finding that classification of people, those poor people that did not own enough property to grow things for themselves. And so they had to go into the corners. And now, how are they supposed to do the work of the wall when it's so difficult for them to feed their own families? Their word that said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many. Their families are growing. They've planted themselves here in Jerusalem to build this wall. And their families are expanding. And they don't have the means to feed their people. It says, for they were that said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore we take up corn for them, that we may eat and live. No one's taking care of them. No one's helping them. Verse number 3. Some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands. Now we got the second group of people. Maybe we can call the first group the poor folks. They own no land. They have no houses. They're gleaning from the corners trying to get whatever they can get. And they have a legitimate complaint. In verse number 3, we've got the middle class. Let's put it that way. There were that said, we have mortgaged our lands. That word mortgage right there, that's the only time that word appears in all the Bible. That's a very relevant word in our day and society, isn't it? All the way back in the book of Nehemiah in the Old Testament, the only time that word shows. And it says, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses that we might buy corn. These in the middle class are experiencing the pressures as much as the other folks were. They have had to go and sell or mortgage their houses and their lands so that they could afford to feed their families. They have sold what they have and everything they've got. And it says at the end of verse number 3, because of the dearth. That's an unusual word, the word dearth. I tried to figure out what's the difference between a dearth and a famine. Are they synonyms? Are they the same thing? And as I Googled it, and dictionaried it and everything else, I couldn't find anybody that could give a distinction between the two. I'm convinced there is one, or else it'd be the same word. But the word dearth is used 8 times in the Bible, mentioning 5 specific different times. The first dearth recorded in the Bible was back in Genesis, when God revealed to Pharaoh and Jacob and or Joseph interpreted a dream that there was going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of a dearth. That's the first dearth that's mentioned in the Bible. I've got these listed somewhere and I've got to find out where I put them. No, I wrote it in my Bible. That's what I did. The second one was in the days of Elisha. There was a dearth in the days of Elisha in 2 Kings chapter 4, verse number 38. He could not feed the sons of the prophets because of the dearth. The third one was in the days of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 14 and verse number 1. Jeremiah prophesied during the days of the dearth. So this is not an unusual thing. The fourth one is here in Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 3. And then the fifth one is all the way over in Acts 11 and verse 28, where the prophet prophesied that in the days of Claudius Caesar, there would be a great dearth over all the land. I thought, well, maybe dearth, maybe famine is in the land, more specific to a place, and dearth is because the Bible says there was a famine in the land. There was a famine in the land. And then there was a dearth. Maybe dearth is more worldwide, but there's a couple places where it said there was a dearth in the land. So that blew my theory to pieces right there. So I'm not sure what the difference is, but there were 5 different distinct periods of dearth. Here's one of them, and because of it, and I'm just imagining this, why was there a dearth? Why were they shut off? Why was there nothing there? Well, if you remember, the enemy in chapter 4 had surrounded the city of Jerusalem. The Ammonites, the Ashdodites, the Arabians, They had surrounded the city, the armed men. There's no food getting in. There's no resupply coming in. Now there's a great dearth as these people are working. It's affecting the lower class, verse 2. It's affecting the middle class, verse 3. It's affecting, and I'm going to go with upper middle class, because we're going to find the upper class in the middle in a minute. But in verse number 4, here it says, there were also that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tribute. See, these folks, these Jews that were given permission to go back and rebuild the wall are still citizens of Persia. They've left Persia to go back and build this wall, but they're still, and they are obligated to pay the taxes to the king. And it says here, we have borrowed money because of this dearth, because of this great need. We have had to borrow money for the king's tribute, and that upon our lands and vineyards. Those that didn't have to mortgage it, that had enough to sustain that for a little bit of time, still are feeling the pinch of this time. Isn't that just like our world and society today? You know, when COVID came, it didn't hit any certain class of people. It hit everybody. It was not an epidemic. It was a pandemic. The difference between epa and pan is regional and worldwide. Pandemic is a worldwide thing. It hit people. It didn't matter if they were movie stars or athletes or common people. It didn't matter who it was. It hit everybody in every kind of class. And when that happens, we're all in the same boat. There's no distinction. There used to be a reality show. I don't know if it's still on, and I never watched it anyways, but it's called The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And I thought, you know, all that's there for is for people to covet and wish they had what somebody else has that they don't have. Well, here we've got the lower class, the middle class, the upper middle class, whatever you want to call these folks. All of them are still feeling the pressure of what's going on. And they said, we have had to borrow money. We still got our houses and lands. We haven't mortgaged that, but we've had to borrow money just to pay our taxes. He says in verse 5, yet now our flesh is the flesh of our brethren. Our children is their children. And lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants. And some of our daughters are brought into bondage already. Neither is in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. All three of these groups of people are being oppressed. They're being manipulated. They're being used for someone else's gain. And Nehemiah says in verse 6, when I heard this, I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Look back at chapter 4. Notice verse number 7. We're going to stumble back onto a great truth that we've already talked about. Chapter 4 and verse 7. You remember as they're building the wall. It said in verse 7, but it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up, and that the breaches began to be stopped, then they were very wroth. Nehemiah in chapter 4 had to deal with the external enemies. Sanballat and Tobiah, Gershom's also mentioned back in chapter 3. And then these three groups, the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites, Nehemiah is fighting off great opposition from the outside. Those that had surrounded the city and were causing trouble. But can I say this in chapter 5? There was a great cry of the people, verse 1, and of their wives. Not against the external enemy. Not against Sanballat and Tobiah. Not against the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, and the Arabians. But look at verse 1. There is a great cry of the people and of the wives. Notice the end, that last sentence. Against their brethren, the Jews. You know who is misusing them in verse 2, 3, and 4? You know who is manipulating them in those verses? It wasn't the enemy. It wasn't the God-haters. It wasn't those opposed to the work of building the wall. It was their brethren, the Jews. We know who they are because if you look down at verse 7, getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, we'll see that Nehemiah says, then I consulted with myself and I rebuke the nobles and the rulers. Those are the two groups that are manipulating the people. The rulers, the nobles, and their rulers. The upper class of the Jews in Jerusalem were taking advantage of everybody else. Doesn't that sound like a very modern problem? We always hear complaints about the upper 2% or the upper 1%. And people say, well, the answer for that is communism or socialism. And countries go into those different forms of government thinking that will solve the solution, only to find out it compounds the solution. Because in Russia, those that are in the Kremlin got everything. They got the nice cars, they got the best cigars, they've got the nicest homes and nicest clothes, but everybody outside of that lives in poverty and works all day long and drinks heavy because it's all they've got to escape the reality of the world they got, the harsh, cold winters, trying to raise their children in situations under communism and socialism that are just unbearable. Can I just say this? Man has no answer. All the governments of this world and the nations of this world will exist until the Lord comes back. Then when He comes back, it's perfect harmony and utopia because He rules and reigns and everything will be fine. But until then, it's just going to be a struggle. And here's the struggle in verse 2, 3, and 4. Those that have, taking advantage of those that do not have. Somebody says, oh, that Bible's old and archaic. You're an idiot. Excuse my blunt language. There's something that was written thousands of years ago, and it's just as real as anything you're going to read today. Those that have are manipulating those that don't have, taking advantage of them through taxes, through interest rates. We're going to see that in just a moment. And the people are complaining. Legitimate complaints that Nehemiah is going to have to deal with because there's a great cry that's coming up. There are three complaints from the three different classes of people. Would be bad enough if those complaints were the source of the enemy oppressing them. But it's not the enemy. It's their own people. You remember we said this last week and talking about this, that when the devil attacks from the outside, he's called the devil. When he attacks from the inside, he's called Satan. And the Bible distinguishes between the two names so we can identify the attack from the outside or from the inside. And here he's doing the same thing in Nehemiah's day. He's attacking by Sanballat, Tobiah, Gershom, and the other groups, or he's attacking by discouraging those that are within it because of the oppression they're facing from the nobles and the elders. There was a great cry, verse number 1. Then look down, if you would, with me at verse number 7. We're going to see three things in this chapter. We've seen one, the great cry. Number 2, we're going to see a great assembly. Look at verse 7. Then I consulted with myself and rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said unto them, ye exact usury, every one of his brother, and I set a, here's our word, great assembly against them. I kind of toyed with the phrase peasant revolt. You've heard of that. Nehemiah said in verse 7, I consulted with myself. I like that. Have you ever done that? You know, there's nothing wrong with talking to yourself. It's when you get answers, that's when the problems start coming. But Nehemiah says, I consulted with myself. Look at this, in verse 6, I was very angry, but I consulted with myself. Can I give you some words of wisdom? When you get angry, pause. Stop for a minute. That's what he did. I consulted with myself. I thought about this for a minute. I waited out. You know, the Bible says in the book of Ephesians, be ye angry and sin not. It's not necessarily a sin to be angry. If it was, Nehemiah sinned in verse 6, and he did not. There's a place in the New Testament where Jesus went into the temple and saw the money changers and all that. You remember that? And the Bible tells that Jesus looked round about him with anger. Jesus was angry when he saw people buying and selling in the temple. Jesus was angry. It's not wrong. It's not a sin to be angry. Be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. It's not wrong to be angry. It's wrong to stay angry. So what Nehemiah did, he consulted with himself. If I get mad or I get angry, you know what I try to do? Go into a different room all by myself and close the door and have it out with just me. Take time away from everybody else. You know, most of us, I'm talking a bunch of sinners just like me, and so don't look at me like you don't know what I'm talking about. Some of the most foolish things we've ever said in our life, we said when we were angry at someone. Because we lost control. We said things that never should have been said. Sometimes things we didn't even mean. We did it because we're angry. Oh, I'm thankful I've got the Bible to keep me straight and keep me moderated. He said, I was very angry, then I consulted with myself. Then I rebuked the nobles and the rulers. After he took some time. You know, Nehemiah was a man of prayer. When I read through Nehemiah today, I recorded all the instances in which he prayed. There are some times where the prayer of Nehemiah is two or three verses. There are some times where it's only a statement saying, I prayed, and it doesn't even record the prayer. But in these first six chapters, especially of Nehemiah, before it moves on to other things, Nehemiah prayed often. And I believe when he said, and I consulted with myself, he had a little quiet time and got some clear direction at what step he should take next. And I rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said unto them, ye. Notice that word ye? That's the plural. All right? Ye, talking about not thou, but ye, plural. I rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said, ye exact usury, every one of his brother. Who was it that was doing the things in verse 2, 3, and 4? It was the nobles and the rulers of the people. They were taking advantage of everybody else. They were saying, they were the loan sharks, basically is what they were. Hey, you need money to buy corn? I'll give it to you at a rate. Oh, you need to mortgage your house? Well, I'll give you so much for it. But it wasn't a fair price at a rate. Oh, you need to pay the king's taxes? Well, that's fine. Here's my rate. And if you don't pay it, we're going to take your sons and daughters to be laborers to work. And we're going to take your vineyards. You see what they were doing? Wasn't Nehemiah justified in being angry? You know, if Nehemiah wasn't angry, I'd be angry. I like what it says. I rebuke the nobles and the rulers. You know, it's easy to rebuke the common people. But we need more Nehemiahs. We need more that aren't afraid to go after the nobles and the rulers. Folks get around them and they all of a sudden tone down things and they're not so brash and not so bold. I like the Nehemiahs of the Bible. You remember Elijah? After he said there'd be no rain in that big battle on top of Mount Carmel, Ahab goes looking for him, and Ahab finds Elijah appears to Ahab, and Ahab says to Elijah, "Hast thou found me, O mine enemy?" That's what Ahab called Elijah. Elijah wasn't his enemy. "Hast thou found me, O my enemy?" And Elijah says to him, he said, "You are the reason that the heavens had been shut up and there's no breath." Elijah wasn't afraid to put his finger in the face of the king and rebuke him for it. We need more Elijahs and Nehemiahs. More Nathans. Remember Nathan when he stood before David and gave him the parable about the rich man that stole the poor man's sheep to feed the wayfaring man? And Nathan pointed at David and said, "Thou art the man." You know, that took some boldness. That took some confidence. Nehemiah had that. I think of Daniel with Belshazzar when Belshazzar was having that great feast and everybody was drinking and dancing and having a wild time. And a hand appeared, just a hand appeared, and wrote on the wall, "Many, many, tekel upharsin." And he said, "What in the world does that mean?" And they called Daniel in to read the writing on the wall. And he said to Belshazzar, the king, he said, "I'll tell you what that reading says." Now, you know, some modern day preachers would never have interpreted what that said on there. They'd have made up something off the top of their head. But he said, "I'll tell you what it says. Thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. God's going to take the kingdom from you." We need more Daniels, more Elijahs, more Nathans, more Nehemiahs. I consulted with myself and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers. Look over at chapter 13. We'll get ahead of ourselves here very quickly, but look at chapter 13. You know, the nobles and the rulers, the nobles are mentioned all through the book of Nehemiah. In fact, that word nobles appears more times in Nehemiah than any other book of the Bible. And the nobles were a thorn in Nehemiah's flesh. So were the leaders. Now remember, Nehemiah is the governor. The nobles and the leaders are the council just under him. And then there's all the people. Lower class, middle class, upper middle class. And Nehemiah as the leader is getting on the nobles and the leaders, the rulers, because they're taking advantage of the people. And he rebuked them, it says in verse 5. All the way over to chapter 13, when we get to the end of the book, they haven't straightened out. Look at verse number 25. Not verse 25, what verse do I want? Chapter 13, verse 17. In verse 17, and I contended with the nobles. Contended. I contended with the nobles. And then it says, oh, now I'm going to mess my references. There's one that says, I contended with the leaders. What is it? 11? Thank you. Can't read my own writing. Verse 11, then I contended with the rulers. There you go, the rulers in verse 11. And the nobles in verse 17. Nehemiah had to have a constant watch over his Congress, over his House of Representatives. Verse 13:11, I contended with the rulers. 13:17, I contended with the nobles, the same two groups back here in chapter 5 and verse number 7 that he had to rebuke at that time. He had to keep a close eye on them. You know what they were supposed to be, the rulers and the nobles? The servants of the people. They were to be the servants of the people. But instead, they were padding their own pockets. They were making themselves wealthy. Boy, isn't that Bible old and outdated? That the political leaders in their country back then were taking advantage of everybody else to make themselves wealthy. It said in verse number 7, ye exact usury. You know what usury is? Usury is interest. As we said already in verse 2, 3, and 4, these leaders and nobles were extending credit to these other people, knowing full well they weren't going to be able to pay it back, and they could grab their lands and their vineyards and even their sons and their daughters. They were exacting usury. You know the law of Moses forbid that? For a Jew to claim usury on another Jew, it was forbidden by the law of Moses. I believe they give us the rate. Look at verse 11, jumping ahead very quickly. Restore, I pray you to them. Is that where I want? Yes. Restore, I pray you to them even this day their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, and their houses. Also the hundredth part of the money. If I understand that right, that was the usury. That was the interest rate they were charging the people. The hundredth part. Now you know what the hundredth part is. A tenth is 10%. A hundredth is 1%. They were charging the people 1% interest, compounded monthly, so 12% annually. They were charging these people who had no way to pay it back, no way in the dirt to get that, and they were making a profit off these people, buying their lands, buying their children, buying everything they possessed and owned, buying it for themselves with the curse of the law hanging over their head, because Moses said, thou shalt not do this. I consulted with myself and rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said unto them, ye exact usury, every one of his brother, and I set a great assembly against them. Nehemiah's response shows true leadership. He got angry when the people were being abused, when they were being misused. He was a servant of the people. These others were using the people for their personal gain. He wanted to serve the people and make sure they were taken care of. Oh, we need more Nehemiahs today. We need Nehemiahs in the political realm. Those that would go into office and serve as servants, not as masters. Verse 8, and I said unto them, we after our ability have redeemed our brethren the Jews, which were sold unto the heathen, and will ye even sell your brethren? Or shall they be sold unto us? Then held they their peace and found nothing to answer. I appreciate that Nehemiah was forceful enough in his words that they didn't even have an argument to give. The Bible said, they held their peace and found nothing to answer. He said in verse 9, also I said, it is not good that you do. Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies? Those enemies outside the gates are watching us and watching what we're doing. They notice what you're doing. They see how you're taking advantage of them. He said in verse 10, I likewise and my brethren and my servants might exact of them money and corn. Nehemiah said, I could do what you're doing. I'm the top dog. I'm the governor of the land. I'm the leader. I could have these people serving me. I could be making a profit off of them. I could be increasing my bottom line and my portfolio if I wanted to. He said, I and my brethren and my servants might do the same thing of them. But you know what he said? I fear the God of heaven. I pray you let us leave off this usury. He tells them to refrain. He's got these people down and he's talking to them and he said, don't do this anymore. And then he says in verse 11, restore. Refrain and then restore. Restore, I pray you, to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, and their houses. That's what they'd taken from the people. And the 100th part of the money, and of the corn, and of the wine, and of the oil that ye exact of them. And they said in verse 12, we will restore them. I like that. They make a promise. Notice the word promise is here three times. One at the end of verse 12, that they should do according to this promise. Once in the middle of verse 13, that performeth not this promise. One at the end of verse 13, and the people did according to this promise. They made a promise here. And it was a fine promise. We will restore them. And we will require nothing of them. So will we do as thou sayest. See what good leadership can do? It can even straighten out the nobles and the rulers. They made a fine promise. They made a firm promise. Look at the end of verse 12. Then I called the priests and took an oath of them, the them is the rulers and nobles, that they should do according to this promise. Here he's got the nobles and the rulers in front of the great assembly. They make a promise. We'll restore everything. We'll give everything back that we've taken. And so Nehemiah brings the priests in and says, all right, I want you to make a vow in the presence of the priests. In the presence of this assembly. And it says, they took an oath of them that they should do according to this promise. It was a fine promise. It was a firm promise. Verse 13, it was a fearful promise. Nehemiah says, and also I shook my lap. Nehemiah is sitting there in his regal robe, and he takes the robe. Imagine you and I do this, eating in the car. Not that I ever do that. And you get crumbs all down the front of you. When you got that Father's Day, you got that cookie as you were given as you went out, and you didn't wait till you got home. You ate it in the car on the way home. And the crumbs get all down there. So you shake your shirt, you shake something to get all that off it. That's what Nehemiah is doing. Symbolically, he's shaking his lap. And he says to them, so God shake out every man from his house and from his labor that performeth not this promise. Even thus be he shaken out and emptied. They make a fearful promise. Nehemiah pictures before them, when he shakes out his lap, he says, this is what I'm asking God to do to any one of you that backs down from the promise you just made, that doesn't keep your oath of office. May God shake him out. And all the congregation said, amen. And praise the Lord. Notice this. And the people did according to this promise. It was a fulfilled promise. Nehemiah and the great assembly. The third section of Nehemiah and the final section, verse 14 to verse 19, is a great example. A great cry, verse 1 to 6. A great assembly, verse 7 to 13. And a great example, verse 14 to 19. In verse 14, Nehemiah says, moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, From the 20th year even to the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, that is 12 years, I and my brethren, notice this, have not eaten the bread of the governor. He says that again at near the end of verse number 18. For yet all this required not I the bread of the governor. You know why Nehemiah was such a good leader? He rebuked the nobles and the rulers. But he also cared about the people. He knew they had enough burden on them. He didn't demand of them to supply for him, which legally he could have required. He's the governor of the land. He can do whatever he wants to. But he had a heart for the people. And he said, I have not eaten the bread of the governor. He could demand, hey, you go get corn and bring it into me. You go find bread today and bring it into me. You get what I need, then worry about yourself. He had the legal right to do that. And the governors before him, verse 15, but the former governors that had been before me were chargeable unto the people, and had taken of them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yea, even their servants bear rule over the people, but so did not I because of the fear of God. Oh, God, give us some more Nehemiahs. Give us some people that fear God before they fear lobbyists. Fear God before they fear their constituents. Fear God before they fear man. The fear of man bringeth a snare. Nehemiah said, I would not take advantage of the people, even that which I had a right to do. I could have asked them for bread and wine, 40 shekels of silver. I could have had my servants rule over them, but I didn't do that because of the fear of God. Not only did he not do that, but notice what he did, verse 16. Yea, also, I continued in the work of this wall. Nehemiah didn't stop what he was doing. He continued working. He himself continued working. He didn't take any pay for it. He donated his pay to charity, maybe, while he built the wall. Oh, no, that's old-fashioned stuff. That has nothing to do with today. Yea, I have continued in the work of this wall. Notice this, neither bought we any land. You know what the government calls that? Eminent domain. They can come in and take anything anytime they want to if they need it for something. They need to build a highway, Betty? They need to build a highway? They can split your farm right down the middle and put I-77 right there. Eminent domain. You know what Nehemiah said? Neither bought we any land. He said, and all my servants were gathered thither unto the work. Not only did Nehemiah work, but those, his servants, he said, hey fellas, if you're on my team, if you're on my committee, you're putting your hand to the work as well as I do. We're all doing this together. We're all this in together. You see why we're going to read later that this wall got done in 52 days. You know why it happened? Because of Nehemiah. A lesser leader would have never accomplished what Nehemiah accomplished. That's why I love this book. I love his example. They have leadership conferences all across the United States. All you need to know leadership is read Nehemiah. That'll give you everything you need to know. You can save money. You don't have to buy so-and-so's book or that. Just read Nehemiah, the first six chapters. You'll have everything you need. He rebuked the nobles and the rulers. He made them vow and promise not to take any more from the people. He made his own people work for what they got. He didn't buy any land. He says in verse 17, moreover, there were at my table 150 of the Jews and rulers, beside those that came unto us from among the heathen there about us. Now, verse 17 or 18 are very... I've painted a picture of Nehemiah up to this point, and if you're not careful with verse 18, you're going to think we're going to blow the whole thing. Look at verse 18. Now that which was prepared for me daily was one ox and six choice sheep. Also fowls were prepared for me, and once in 10 days, store of all sorts of wine. So Nehemiah had 150 people sitting at his table every day. He is a political leader. He meets with his council. He meets with his rulers. He meets with the heathen that are about us. He had to have councils with them and talk with them. His foreign relations. And he had to do something. And so when he met with them at that table, there was prepared for me one ox, 6 choice sheep, fowls, and every 10 days store of all sorts of wine. You say, well, he was getting something from the people. Well, here's the challenge. Look at this. Look at 1 Kings chapter 4. Turn back to the left there a little bit. 1 Kings chapter 4. Let's put Nehemiah in contrast with another leader and look at his table. And then we'll understand that Nehemiah is being humble. 1 Kings chapter 4. Now keep that and look at, we're almost done here. Look at Nehemiah chapter 5 also. Look at verse 18. Now that which was prepared for me daily, we'll see that word also in 1 Kings. That which was prepared for me daily, this is Nehemiah 5:18, was one ox. All right, you got that? One ox. Now go back to 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 22. And Solomon's provision for one day, all right, daily, for one day, was 30 measures of fine flour and 60, that's 60 measures of meal. Look, notice verse 23. 10 fat oxen and 20 oxen out of the pasture. Solomon is feeding his table 30 oxen a day. Nehemiah's got one. The contrast is simply to show this. Now, I know I'm not trying to bash Solomon. Solomon was wealthy. The kingdom flourished under his day. But you see what he did? He took the right of kings, and he had this provision made every day. It says 10 fat oxen, 20 oxen out of the pasture, 100 sheep, besides harts, which are deer, and roebucks, bigger deer, and fallow deer, smaller deer, and fatted fowl. Solomon's table was a pretty full table. Nehemiah, in contrast to that, had just what he needed. No more. Now that which was prepared for me daily was one ox of 6 choice sheep. Also fowls were prepared for me in one day and 10 days store of all sorts of wine. Yet for all this required not I the bread of the governor. Nehemiah says again, I didn't take what I could have taken. I didn't take what was rightfully and legally mine because the bondage was heavy upon this people. Nehemiah did not make rules and laws that didn't apply to him and his constituents. They did not pass laws that didn't apply to them. Isn't that a great lesson? You know that's not true in our country? That our Congress passes laws and regulations that they're not obligated, they're not required to keep, especially concerning health care. Nehemiah said, because the bondage of the people was heavy upon this people. Everything he did was regulated by common sense and a sense of servitude, duty, and humility. What a great servant. What great leadership. You know, our colonial forefathers, our first presidents and servants, congressmen, were not paid. They would get a stipend if they had to travel to Philadelphia. That was before Washington, D.C. was the capital. If they had to travel to Philadelphia, they tried to give them something to cover their travel. But those representatives didn't get paid for what they did. They were public servants. Now somehow that title has carried over to modern times, but that philosophy hasn't. But Nehemiah had that. He said, I'm a servant of the people. And that's why the work got done. Yes, there was some complaining that took place when somebody stepped out of line, but Nehemiah got him in line real quick. I rebuked the rulers and the nobles. Verse 19. Think upon me, my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. A consciousness of God and a reality that one day we will give an account of ourselves before God will cause us to do the right things. You know why people are crooked? They don't think they're ever going to have to answer to God. They think in this life they're going to get whatever they want to, get away with what they want to, and when they die, everything's over and it's done. No, it doesn't work that way. I'm sorry. You are going to give an account for the things you've done in the body, whether it be good or bad. Nehemiah understood that. He said, God, remember me. I have done all that I can to be the right kind of leader for this people, to accomplish the right task, because he feared God. Verse number 15, because of the fear of God. When there is no fear of God, things aren't right. There's a quote here I want to read and I'll close with it. Oswald Chambers has said, the remarkable thing about fearing God is that when you fear God, you fear nothing else. Whereas if you do not fear God, you fear everything else. Nehemiah said, think upon me, O God, because I fear you and I've done right for the people. We need Nehemiah leadership in our day. Let's stand together this evening with our heads bowed and our eyes closed.